Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Biz Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Boleyn. Today on the show, I am talking with Craig Watson, who is the co-founder of Soundwave, a popular music discovery app. They also make an SDK called Shine that helps developers learn about the mobile music habits of their user base and provide them with better recommendations when they first install a new music app. I'm going to talk to Watson about how Soundwave's product and focus has changed as they learned more about the mobile music sector. Make sure that you subscribe to Music Biz Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest episodes on SoundCloud. And if you like this show, I'd love for you to rate us highly and submit a review on iTunes. Here is my interview with Craig Watson. So first off, Craig, I want you to talk about what Soundwave does. Yes, it's a mobile app. It allows me to share music with my friends. What's the larger strategy here?
Sure. So thanks very much for having me on the show. I'm delighted to be talking with you today. To give you a little bit of context around Soundwave, we originally started the company, three founders, myself, Brendan, and Aidan, because we thought it was just too difficult to understand what the other person was listening to on their mobile device. We're big fans of Last.fm and what they'd achieved on the web. I felt that potentially they dropped the ball and there was a little bit of an opportunity for someone to do something similar on mobile and really to index the listening graph of a user with the simple concept that I could go on to Brendan's or Aidan's profile and understand what they've been listening to and discover that music frictionlessly and not have to rely on them to manually push their music to any other service and have it agnostic to source as well. So we could pull from native plays on mobile, video on mobile, or from various streaming services on mobile as well. So we set out nearly 3 years ago at this stage to build a consumer app that did exactly that. We got a little bit of seed money in, raised some capital from Mark Cuban and some other investors like U2's management and Act Venture Capital, and built out the team with the concept of building essentially an Instagram for music, so that instead of seeing what photos your friends were actually taking, you would see what music they're consuming. And so we launched the product in July of 2013. Since then, we've scaled it up to nearly a couple of million downloads, and we're in about 180 countries. So it's been a hell of a ride. It's been a lot of fun, but we've learned a lot of lessons around the music discovery space, and looking forward to talking with you about that a little bit more today.
And another recent update that you did included a focus on group messaging as well.
Correct, yeah. So the original version of the app was essentially a monologue in that you could see what someone was listening to, but there wasn't a whole lot of social interaction around that. So we did a lot of user research in the consumer space. I guess the user is our customer, and we always want to make sure that we're amplifying the best bits of the product to meet the customer's demands. And it became clear that they were looking for more of a way to connect with each other. So you might get into a certain artist that you really liked, but there wasn't any way to actually communicate with one another. So version two was actually just about thinking, how do we build in messaging and how can we reinvent the app to allow people to talk back and forth about their favorite artists? And so we've built in some messaging functionality that allows you to share music back and forth, but also to strike up a conversation either with friends or with strangers. And that's either public or private. So what we've been working on in the background is actually more of a community feel as well, so that you can join a certain group or a certain community that you want to discuss with your friends or with strangers and allow them to have that social piece in addition to the music discovery element.
Are there any interesting communities that have formed on Soundwave?
Yeah, there is actually. There's some really interesting. I'm always amazed by the creativity of some of the users in the community that we have. There's one, Grateful for the Dead, which is actually a really, really busy community, and essentially it's people sharing artists that are no longer with us and that they respect and that they really like. For me, it's actually been a really cool discovery tool, because there might be people maybe different generation than myself who I might not have come across the artist before, and you know, I'm understanding the context a little bit more and the history of that artist, not just the individual song and understanding why that particular user in the community likes them and how they discover them in the past. So there's a number of very interesting use cases that I've come across since developing the messaging functionality in the product.
Very interesting. Can you talk briefly about how you collect the music data from all these different services? It seems like there was a lot of ingenuity there that allowed you to track that data in a unique way.
Sure. It took a long time to get right. We initially started out, everyone said that we would probably need to build a music player to actually be able to track from one individual source. And that's not what we wanted to do. As I said at the start, we wanted to keep the journey as frictionless as possible. So we spent nearly 9 months at the start getting the technology right. We now have 6 patents basically on the capturing mechanisms. And it's slightly different for both ecosystems. So on Android, it's a little bit more open and it's a little bit easier to pull from services. On Apple, it took more of a workaround, and there was a little bit of ingenuity, I suppose, and kudos to our developers who spent a long time getting this right. And a funny story is actually when we finally did crack it on iOS, we reached out to Eddie Q and basically told him what we had done. And we weren't really sure if he was going to pat us on the back or kick us out of the App Store, because it was something I don't think that had ever been done before. And thankfully, he really liked it. He passed it on to the marketing team, and they actually put their full weight and supported us when we launched. So we had Stephen Fry as an early adopter, and actually even Steve Wozniak was using the product when we launched back in July 2013. So thankfully, the hard work paid dividends.
Absolutely. You had a very splashy launch.
I think that's probably a fair comment. Splashy is something I think in the consumer space that you need to be. You have 1 million+ apps in both stores, and I think actually it's market risk is probably the biggest hurdle for most app developers. It's not technical risk. And for us, we were always interested in building an app that scaled to millions of people. And to do that, we spent a lot of time thinking about how we could launch and get traction and get as much exposure as possible when we did actually launch the product. So I think hopefully we did our job right.
I don't think you could have executed the launch better.
That's good to know. Thanks, Scott.
So where do you see Soundwave going in the future?
Sure. We've taken our fundamental technology and we're actually now, so to give a little bit more of a background, as we've been working with a number of the third-party music services, it became clear that what we had built might actually be of interest for them to use. And originally it was going to be a value exchange whereby we would provide music discovery tech in return for potentially some content from the third-party services who were hosting the music. And those discussions elevated then into something a little bit more B2B and a little bit more tangible. And where we're at now is we spent the last few months actually packaging all our technology into a software development kit or into an SDK that can be integrated on Android and iOS by any music app. And what that will do is it'll allow the music app to understand the listening tastes of the user and work out what their music fingerprint is on mobile at the stage of registration. So when they have installed the app for the very first time, and then as they register and consume music, we're picking up their listening graph from a number of different sources. So if you think of the value proposition for, let's just say, ABC Streaming Limited, if they, for the first time, someone downloads the ABC app, they've not very much information on that user, and there's usually a generic welcome email, and then it takes them, a little bit of time to get used to what that user likes. Actually, case in point is probably Apple's latest music offering, where the onboarding, if I'm being brutally honest, kind of sucked, and I thought it wasn't great. You had to go in and try and juggle with these bouncing balls and work out which genre you liked, and I can talk to my designer about this. He had a lot of issues because there was just a lot of UX flaws where you actually couldn't go back on certain functions or certain actions that you'd made. And once you'd picked a genre, it was difficult to actually change that. So instead of manually selecting what genre you want as a user going in, because the Soundwave SDK is embedded into these products, we can actually work out what your listening tastes are from other services and then feed that back into ABC streaming. And that way they have a much smoother onboarding and much more personalized experience. So we're just taking our technology that we've built on the consumer-facing app, packaging it into an SDK, and essentially labeling that as music personalization as a service. And it's resonated quite well so far, and it's been fun actually, and a bit of a challenge now working in a slightly different domain.
So you're going to help ABC streaming with the cold start problem.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
And what things could you help this company with beyond that?
So I think besides the cold start, which is important to get right, I also think that if you think, you know, 30 days or in Apple's case, 3 month trial, that's quite a short window to get people to convert from free to paid. And any data points that you can have to help them make that conversion. So if you can provide the right content at the right time, that's something I believe that is going to be hugely valuable, because even if it's a 0.5% or 1 point uplift on conversion from free to paid, it still could make a massive difference to the top line figures of one of these services, because ultimately that's what they're all trying to achieve. I'm sure you've covered it before in a couple of the podcasts, but you know, there's question marks over the free model and ad supported. And if you can convert people from free to paid because you understand what their preferences are and they feel like they're having a great experience and that you actually understand them as a user, you're not just one of a million users, then there'd be value in that going forward. So it is a cold start for the very first user journey experience and that very first time you're using the product. But then also going forward, I think our SDK could potentially add as much value.
So what does that data dashboard look like to ABC streaming company? Like, what information are they seeing about me or the larger cohort of users?
It very much depends. I mean, I would assume that you have quite a visible and quite a strong music fingerprint. And so for yourself, we can actually show what services you've been listening to. We could show your favorite artists. We could show your time of day that you like to listen to music, your day of the week. We can actually show like anti-charts as well, so who you don't like. Things also like what videos you've watched on YouTube, native files that have been consumed on your device. It really depends on it. That's, I suppose, the beauty of it, is that everyone has their own unique profile or their own unique fingerprint. And our job is to surface that for each user. And it depends. Some people maybe aren't listening to a lot of music on their mobile device, and it's harder to actually surface a good music fingerprint. But you'd be amazed at actually just how many people are even listening to MP3s still on their devices, because maybe they don't have cache music, or maybe they're not paying for a subscription tier, so they can't listen offline. And we can tell a lot, and we can actually surface quite an amount. The other part that we're working on, which is interesting, is trying to infer demographic data from music listening tastes. So what I mean by that is, you would actually be able to tell that before you've registered on the service, I could tell that Kyle is, you know, potentially 20 to 40 year old male based over in the US, and these are his interests. And that's kind of something our data scientists have been working on for the last few months to get right, because for services where there's a registration flow that potentially they allow people in to listen to music before they register, that's really helpful information. So to convert them either to the registration section, or even it could be used in advertising. There's a number of use cases where if they don't have that information, we can help serve it up by inferring the data from the listening habits and from another other data points that we're capturing from the device.
And that's technology that you built with the initial version of SoundWave that you have patented and now rolled into this kind of business-to-business service.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the best way of thinking of it is that the consumer-facing app was the ultimate test for our technology. It's still live. We're still enjoying using it, and the communities are all still using the product. But we've seen an opportunity here to package it up into something that's maybe resonates a little bit more in the B2B space.
You mentioned that I might be surprised to learn how many people are still listening to MP3s. Are there any other surprising things that you've learned, or could you at least expand on that comment about MP3s?
Yeah, sure. So we spent about 4 months between, I think it was October till about January last, and just went out and did a lot of research with our users, but also with general teenagers to try and get an understanding, because they're typically our target demographic that we were targeting with the consumer app. And we had a very much an open book. Myself and a colleague went around to colleges. Typically, we're spending 4 or 5 hours out of the office every day just to get a general understanding of how teens are consuming music. And the results completely blew us away, especially on how they were using different services. So, for example, most of them had actually tried paid services and had reverted back to free. And we thought originally maybe this was a credit card issue, but it wasn't. It was just that there wasn't really any moral hang-up in using free music, and that there were so many good alternatives that were free that they just weren't really willing to pay for a subscription streaming service. So you're probably familiar with what I would call YouTube wrapper apps, which is essentially just an app that uses YouTube and has, it's an illegal app essentially that has no content of its own, but it allows these teenagers to cache the music. And what happens typically in the app stores is that, one will fly a little bit close to the sun and it'll get too high up the charts, and Apple or Google will just squash it, and then another one will just come and follow in its place. And they were using these, I would say, from the hundreds of teens that we were talking to, probably over 50% were using these wrapper apps that are free to download and have all the content you'd ever need. So that was quite shocking. And we hadn't actually really optimized our product to capture music from those apps. So that was one learning that we then changed in our own offering. Another thing I suppose that was quite interesting with teenagers, again, it was the MP3s. And I think it's probably a little bit of a hang up from the days of either torrents or just MP3 converters, or maybe it's just big iTunes libraries. But I think MP3s sometimes are neglected, or because we're kind of in the music sphere and we talk about streaming and the kind of the top 10% or the aficionados, as we call them, there's still a huge body and a huge vertical of consumers who are still listening to MP3s on their devices. And it's, it's the music is there, it's stored locally, you don't need to have any internet. And it actually, there's quite a variance between region and also between ecosystems. So for example, somewhere like Russia and Android, or Brazil and Android, would have huge kind of MP3 consumption patterns. And then somewhere maybe like the Valley or New York or London, you'd see a lot more streaming and what we'd be more used to. But there is no one size fits all. I think the most interesting part, and probably the biggest challenge for the labels and for various services, is how do you appeal to such a wide demographic and where do you target? And I think that's where a lot of these guys have their work cut out.
And it's been interesting because a lot of these companies have really started to focus on context as their strategy, whether that be your activity or your mood. They are trying to help surface playlists that align with that.
That's right. It was a post I put up actually on Medium just about, it was a soundbite from Paul Lemire, who's one of the founders of Econest, who Spotify acquired, and he said context is a new genre. He basically mined all the playlists on Spotify and saw that I think it was 41 of the top 100 playlists were genre-based. And what I mean by that is, instead of saying, you're into hip-hop or classical music or jazz, it's beach, or it could be running, or it could be in the car or in the shower. And it's, if you think about it, it's something that I suppose has evolved, because it's the first time really in history that we've been able to understand the why of someone, why someone is consuming music. So to understand that, you need certain sensors on the device. You need to be understand the environment that they're in. And we're now at a stage in mobile technology where there's enough sensors to actually work out that environment. So Spotify released a product, you probably saw it, called Running a month back. And they also were looking at something called Relevance. And they're both really cool features. And the press actually picked up on, I thought, the wrong stuff. They were talking about content and how Spotify was potentially becoming getting into video. But they kind of neglected to focus or didn't really spend any time talking about these product updates that the guys obviously have spent a lot of time working on, understanding, you know, if you're going for a run, understanding what your BPM is and then the song adapting to that. And although it might sound a bit gimmicky as a kind of once-off use case, I think you can't really look at it through that narrow a lens. You need to really open the aperture and think about how the Internet of Things might apply for music in the future. So context is something we spent a lot of time looking at, because we feel there's definitely a spectrum between services that rely on human curation. So services, I'd actually probably put Apple in that group now. I've been using it for the past week. I'm an Android user, but I've been using it on Mac. And I'm a big fan of, I was a big fan of Zane Lowe on BBC, and I'm still enjoying his stuff on Beats One. And I think he's a great DJ. He curates some really cool music. But where they potentially drop the ball, I think, is on the context piece and understanding from the ground up what the user wants. And I talked a little bit at the top of the show about the onboarding not being great. On the flip side of that, I think Spotify is actually getting very strong at that part. And they're spending more and more time looking at the metadata around a song and understanding where it has been played. And what that allows is it basically puts the user first. And instead of relying on someone like Zane to dictate what music I'm listening to, it's much more personalized, and it'll understand my tastes and then suggest, you know, what music I might like. So examples might be running is an obvious one, but even using like the motion sensor potentially as you're going to bed, knowing the time of day, or the light sensor as you're in your room, turning off the phone or turning off the music as you're going to bed. You know, there's a million different ways it can be applied. You could use the humidity sensor when you're in the shower, co-presence device sensor. So when I get into my car and I want to connect to the Wi-Fi in my car, it'll know that I'm in my car and that I listen to certain tracks or I like certain music. And this whole idea of basically implementing an AI-driven approach. And there's a lot of work that still needs to be done to get that right. But I think that's what's exciting. And I think that's an area where more and more services will invest time and invest resources. And be very interesting to see which way the consumers go, whether the human-curated angle still wins out, or does this personalization and understanding the user and the context piece offer more to a consumer?
I've always been fascinated with the potential for what I call Music Now, which is the intersection of Google Now and Songza. In Google Now, it surfaces all these different cards related to things that you've searched for or specific data that it's finding in your email. I've always wondered, like, at what point do they get really good and really specific about the songs of playlists they're able to surface to you in a given moment, and making it really easy to use the voice search to add the specific parameters of a playlist that you're seeking out?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that'd be really cool. And obviously, Google are really well placed to do that. They've spent the last 15 years indexing data, and they'd be as well placed as anyone to do it. I actually think what you said, I mean, ultimately what you'd like to do is just take your phone and press play in any situation. And if there's enough context awareness, then potentially they'll get that song right. And I mean, how awesome would that be if you could actually just in any context, not even have to think, to remove the cognitive load and just press play and for them to get it right. I think there is, as I mentioned, you know, I had a debate with one of my developers over this, and he'd probably be a little bit closer to how fast the AI side of that is actually progressing. But even getting it a little bit more improved, I think could offer huge, huge rewards for a listener. And it would be quite novel. I think the services that are looking at this the most stand to actually benefit the most at the same time.
I was doing a user research call a few months ago, and after talking to someone for a while, I basically just asked them directly, like, okay, so you have these various problems with these various services, like, what do you want? And I know it's like, you're not supposed to ask someone what they want, but their answer was so perfect. They just said, I just want a giant play button that I can hit that gives me relevant music that's new, fresh, and interesting when I want it. And I was like, exactly. The music button. That's what you want.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, in fairness to laid back services, I mean, the radio is a perfect example where essentially that's what you're doing, but you're putting your hands in the trust of a DJ or someone to curate that music. But when the context piece and that personalization can get to the stage where it's as strong, if not stronger, because Beats One is the same music for 180 countries, you know, that there's going to be people who aren't going to enjoy that type of music. But just the whole, you know, replicating that experience and getting the radio experience right by just pressing play, I think is a huge, huge opportunity. And I see it very much. The Internet of Things in music is very well placed in my view, just because it's not that consequential. You know, you can, okay, worst case, you get the song wrong. It does piss people off. And, you know, it leads to people maybe not using that radio service if they've got it wrong a few times. But there's a big difference between that and, say, understanding where someone is on a dating app and then someone being able to discover another person's address because they've given up certain signals. And I think the Internet of Things with music is really well placed, because that value exchange between privacy and the upside of actually getting the content right is skewed in favor of the music industry.
How do you think the Internet of Things is going to change music and how we interact with it in our daily lives?
I guess it depends on the supporting infrastructure. So at the rate things are moving, we're probably going to go to something like 5 billion smartphones in the next 50 months. I believe that's about right. And with those, a whole host of sensors on the devices. When you get to a stage where there's enough infrastructure there, I think it's well placed to make a big difference. Again, there will be obviously huge regional differences. Certain devices don't nearly have as many sensors or as good a context awareness structure that the other devices might have. But the biggest change for me, I think, is it's basically just a matter of time before there is adoption, and it moves from kind of early innovators into the mass majority, and then eventually into the laggards. And it's just kind of a typical diffusion of innovation. It'll take a little bit of time before all the sensors are actually out there and there's enough infrastructure for it to work. But as I mentioned, I think music is really well placed to take advantage of that, and I think it's going to be really exciting. And hopefully we'll be in a place where we can just all shut our brains off, in a sense, and listen to the music we want based on our context and our environment by just pressing play.
Hopefully that feature doesn't come with those reclining chairs and Wally.
Yeah, or a soft drink. That probably would be a little alarming. But I mean, realistically, there's going to be times where I want to just go off and listen to heavy metal music on a run, and maybe there hasn't been any context for that in the past, and it's just a decision that I'd like to make. But I think there's a sweet spot between suggesting and actually forcing. And suggesting the right music is kind of like what you were talking about with Google now, is just providing the information and still always giving the choice to the user and making sure that they're comfortable listening to that music.
I think that soft drink might be Soylent.
Possibly. Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it.
There's been a lot of consolidation in music tech. Many companies are being acquired or shut down. For example, Soundtracking was acquired by Rhapsody and completely shut down last week. Do you have any thoughts you want to share about the consolidation of music tech? Are you optimistic about it, or are you worried?
Sure. I suppose I'm not really well position to talk about Soundtracking or Rhapsody, both very interesting and very cool businesses in their own sense. But just talking about the consolidation piece, for us, it's something that is definitely an opportunity, because irrespective of what happens with Soundwave, I think chaos is exactly where you want to be when you're a startup. You know, there is probably 12 to 18 months of conflict that's going to take place between the various services, and that's probably a diplomatic way of putting it. And for smaller services, that just means that there's more bandwidth and there's more leverage for them to actually surface what's relevant, what in their own technology stack or their own product, because all these bigger services are going to look for a differentiator. And I talked a little about this in one of the blog posts. You know, in our view, the future music service that's going to win is going to be defined probably by three things. it's songs first and foremost. So making sure that you have a full catalog. And in our view, the race for content is over. I mean, you probably need to have 20 plus million songs unless you get something very, very right on the discovery side. But most of the big services are going to have 20 million songs. The sound itself, so the actual quality of the song, I think now is at a stage where it's probably laws of diminishing returns, where you can invest more and more money. But at a certain stage, only the most hardened audiophiles will actually really care about the quality of the music above what it is now. But the last part is what's interesting, we think, is the sequencing. And that really is how you serve up music to people. And that's where I think the differentiation is going to happen. Whether that's through human curated, social, whether that's through personalization, the context awareness. I mean, ultimately, what you're trying to get is that experience from listening to choosing the music you want and listening to the right music as quickly as possible. And so any services or any third parties, I think, that are focused around that area, whether that's the data side, whether that is on the product, even testing it on the consumption side, but just the sequencing element, I think is one area where the consolidation is going to be quite interesting.
Something that I've been saying since the launch of Apple Music is that music streaming has been reduced to a competition over distribution, marketing, price, and playlist. You obviously just covered the playlist piece quite well. How do you think the distribution, marketing, and price plays into all this?
Yeah, distribution. I mean, Apple's obviously had a huge advantage. I believe something like 40% of people have already upgraded to 8.4. This is literally hundreds of millions of devices which will now have access to Apple Music, which is incredible, really, when you think about it. I mean, imagine us launching a product and getting 400 million users overnight. It's phenomenal head start, and it's a great advantage on the distribution side. Others will take a little bit longer to get to that scale, and they'll have to spend more money to get there. And I think it is a power law, unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever way you want to look at it, that there will only be probably four or five in the end, maybe even less, that will have the distribution to scale it properly and to build out a sustainable business. On the price side, I think there's huge room for innovation there. I think I've seen some interesting companies trying different price points. I believe Audio were trying a lower tier. There was one here in the UK we were looking at that was actually charging like a dollar, or you could pay as you go kind of approach, where you could, you know, buy a very small amount of songs. But I think taking $9.99 as an arbitrary figure or more for a family, for example, is where there's room for innovation. And I won't get into the content or the licensing side or what the cost of that would be, because it's not my area of expertise. But I just think that coming at it from a user-first perspective and talking about my experience with the teenagers, they potentially won't pay $9.99 for unlimited content. But there might be a sweet spot where they would actually pay a certain amount of money to hear a certain amount of music offline. I mean, and cache music is critical for these guys because they're actually paying for data, or they might not have a full all-you-can-eat data plan. So, you know, there's room, and I think there's areas where on price they can definitely differentiate themselves, and it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Is Bloom.fm the service that you were talking about earlier in the UK?
Correct, yeah, and it has since, I think, been disbanded. Maybe it was too much of a radical experiment, but I respected and I was impressed by the innovation in the pricing strategy, if nothing else.
Yeah, it sounded like there was turmoil with their investors or some other complications beyond just maybe their business model or product.
Potentially, I didn't actually hear the full story in the end, but... Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
It sounds like you place a high value on user research and that you've invested potentially hundreds of hours in getting to know your users and music fans in general. What advice would you offer companies who are looking to get more into research, and how valuable has it been for you?
Sure. I'll take the first part. So what advice? I would say basically there are no shortcuts, and it's not glamorous. It just needs to be done. You just need to roll up your sleeves and get out there and spend time talking to teenagers. And it's the nuggets that you get from the questions that are very open that you don't see coming. We have a script, but typically we'll actually go off script quite a lot. And it's, as you mentioned at the start, it's not actually about, you know, asking leading questions about what does someone want. It's just understanding and just mapping their day-to-day behavior. And you'll see something, or you'll see a way that they use a product, and it'll just kind of be a light bulb moment where you're kind of like, shit, we actually really need to put that into our product, or why did we not think of that? And I don't think there is a shortcut. It's getting out there. It's speaking to people in their own environment, making them feel comfortable and as natural as possible. And I think music is relatively easy, because people, you're either into music or you're not, but those who are typically very passionate, and they're happy to talk about how they listen to music, and they're quite open about it, whether that's illegal, legal, free streaming. And so my advice would be to not expect to not rely maybe on agencies or market research outfits. To just, the best way of actually progressing is just to get out there and do it yourself.
And when you start to go out there and do it yourself, it's interesting, because I think at first people like want to talk to each other like they would normally talk, and they kind of want to ask like, you know, so Craig, what do you like about that? This is what I like. But it really is about staying very objective, learning how to probe without adding any bias, and making the user the expert of their life, their situation, and their habits, and never kind of imposing your expertise on them.
Yeah, I'd have to agree 100% with that. And it's something we have to learn, because it's not something you're objectively born with. This objective approach to talking to someone about a product, like the temptation is always to look for confirmation bias and to try and find the answer that you want to find. But I would say there's a couple of resources for anyone that actually would be interested. There's a book by Erica Hall called Just Enough Research, which was very helpful. And that kind of gives a good framework on how to ask the right questions and how not to go overboard, or how to ask the wrong questions. And then more on the teenage side of things, if anyone's spending time looking at that, there's an author called Dana Boyd, D-A-N-A-H-B-O-I-D, who has a book called It's Complicated. And she's a researcher who spent a lot of time looking at teenage behaviors. And they were helpful actually just as a starting point, and they kind of framed our initial research projects when we were talking to teenagers.
Another good one is called Interviewing Users by Steve Portigal.
Nice. I hadn't heard of that. I'll take a note.
It's funny. A couple years ago, I started doing user experience research. And at first, I was so resistant to it, just because I came from a background of being a journalist who got to interview experts. So the notion of going to some bar and talking to strangers just to share it internally was such like a weird notion to me.
Yeah.
But once I did my first remote study and I interviewed probably about 15 people about how they listen to, discover, and interact with music on Spotify, as well as other streaming services, it absolutely just tore my world apart and made me realize that so many of the proclaimed experts in music and technology are maybe experts at one of the two, but definitely not of the consumer themselves and what they're doing at a particular time.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the more experts you get by definition, the probably further away you get from day-to-day consumers. And yeah, we had some hilarious stories of stuff that you would never see coming. But when you're especially around social side of things, the fear and the reluctance to post music on Facebook, for example, because it's like the small things we'd never even thought of, that they're online so often that they believe that there's this online presence. So if they're on Facebook, for example, and they're connected their music to Facebook and it's live streaming what they're listening to, they might actually be trying to study and they might have turned off their G+. So that was just in their heads, that was such a contradiction that their friends would suddenly be able to see what they were listening to and knew that they were online when they said that they were offline studying. And there's just this phobia around privacy. And I think, yeah, it just blew our minds. It was the nuances that we could never have discovered without just going out and talking to people. And like you said, it's kind of an illuminating experience, and one we continue to keep progressing forward and finding more and more light bulb moments when we can.
I look forward to reading when you share them online, hopefully.
Sure. Absolutely.
So, Craig, we've covered a lot of stuff in this conversation. Is there anything else you want to share that we haven't covered?
I think it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for the time. If anyone has any questions about what we're doing at Soundwave, you can either download the app at www.soundwave.com, and it's available on Android and iOS. And for any third-party services or app developers who are interested in using our SDK, we have a dedicated SDK website, basically www.soundwave.com/shine, S-H-I-N-E, which is the name of the SDK, which allows you to essentially shine a light on your users. I'm more than happy to engage with anyone there. If anyone wants to reach out to me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is CDCWatson. Love to continue the conversation on Twitter as well.
Well, Craig, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight.
Great. Thanks very much for your time, Kyle.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thank you to Hypebot for helping us put this show out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion.